If you can wade into the political arena and make it out unscathed, you must be doing something right. Brian Burke is your host for Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Kitchener Today. Here we are, four-fifths of the way through the week. It's Thursday afternoon. Coming up this afternoon, they're coming to get you. They're coming to get you in Kitchener and your dog. And your little dog, too. Kitchener bylaw enforcement officers knocking on doors, reminding people, if you have a dog, you're supposed to buy a dog license. And as we well know, most of us don't. Inclusion, walkability, those are key things to rebuilding cities after the COVID-19 pandemic. The Angus Reid Institute has done an interesting survey on what they call Omicron inevitability. 55% of us apparently say we'll be infected regardless of anything that we do, and about 40% of people would end all restrictions yesterday. And I mentioned just before that children are horrible. They're lazy. They don't have nearly the tough life that we had. All of those things, bones and teeth, are helping to reveal if teenagers have always been a problem. I knew the answer to that before the research started, but it's nice to get it confirmed. And CBD could help prime cells against COVID, but you don't get the buzz. More on that just after 2:30 this afternoon. All of that is coming up. But first,
where in the world?
Brittany Bourlon.
Yeah. You see, last time we did this, I lost track of how many days Brittany had been in exile.
And then he just started making stuff up.
Pretty much.
He went on holiday for 2 weeks, and the number had jumped by like 50.
Yeah. So, I had some time to sit back and reflect. So that's what I did.
Okay.
This is officially day two of the exile of executive producer Brittany Bourlon. Although she maintains her innocence, this keeps happening to her, so what are we to think? Obviously, it's got something to do with her. Perhaps
I've had to have done something.
Perhaps there's a hint there in the maniacal laughter, which some people call engaging. Those people are wrong.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, listen to that laugh.
Yeah, that's evil. Her annoyance, and it with an evil transformed into orangutan. Not you. You're not an orangutan.
He's making fun of me.
Her annoying habit of wearing her toque inside. That's bad. And by the way, it's been taken up by Mark Perry. He now wears his toque inside all the time. Not just
you better watch out, Brian. It's contagious.
Goodness, I don't get it. Or your just general millennial mindset. Whatever it is, you're trapped in an alternate universe in Stratford. For those who don't know, including Brittany, Stratford is in Perth County. Right? Right.
Okay, I knew that it was in Perth County.
Did you?
Thank you very
did
much.
You?
Yes, I did.
When did you learn that? Yesterday.
Not yesterday.
I wonder where we find Brittany today.
Oh, bells of St. Mary. We always.
Here's a song about pretty much anything. You're in beautiful St. Mary's today. Do you know where that
Ooh,
is, Brittany?
Yes, I know where that is. I looked at houses in St. Mary's.
Yes. But St. Mary, also known as Stonetown. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
That's because of all the limestone, which was carved out there and made into some very beautiful buildings. One could also opine the baseball capital of Canada, right, Polly?
I didn't know it was the baseball capital. I knew, of course, that the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame was there.
That's right. Well, that's, to me, that kind of makes it the baseball right. capital of Canada, right? For a long time, Cooper bats were made in St. Mary's and wooden axe handles.
I did not know that.
Same factory. One of the reasons why the Baseball Hall of Fame was moved to St. Mary's. Also, very, 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 very little known fact, actually known only to me. No one else knows this.
Okay.
But it's an actual fact. St. Mary's is the place for the first known mention in the media of me.
What, you, Mr. Brian Burke, right? Radio extraordinaire?
Right. First known mention in the media. An article from the St. Mary's Journal Argus, which I still have, by the way, features me at the tender age of 12. I was the winner of the Oxbow Public School Public Speaking Contest. There's a picture of me in a really bad sweater vest. Circa 1970, which I still have the article. To this very day, that's the first mention of me in any media outside of, I don't know if my parents put a birth announcement in the paper, so that doesn't count.
Yeah, we pretty much all have that, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So this is the very first mention. Going back almost, well, some 50 years, I'm holding on to that for my Waterloo Hall of Fame induction.
Wow.
Pretty exciting, huh?
I didn't know there was a Waterloo Hall of Fame.
Yeah, there is. There's Waterloo County Hall of Fame.
All right. And you're not in it?
No, not yet.
You should be.
I think you have to be dead.
You really should, huh?
I think you have to be dead. I'm not sure.
Well, that's not good. See,
no.
You're not all, you should be able to be alive to enjoy it.
I think so. You know, we should get in, like, now would be a good idea. I don't know how much time I have left.
But with all this cancel culture stuff, who knows? You got to make sure. Well, of course, you can still figure out stuff after people have died, stuff that they did, like the Kaufman guy.
At that point, I no longer care. You can slag me all I want once I'm gone. No concern to me whatsoever.
All right. Today is National Rubber Ducky Day.
Really? It's not all it's blacked up
Brittany,
to be.
Brittany, you should have had me play the Rubber Ducky song from Ernie.
Okay, I thought about that right at noon, and I was like, nope, I can't do the, you know, 2 minutes to the show.
Yeah, Farwell already dump did that to Farwell me once does. Today. Thank you,
yeah,
Brittany.
You're welcome. Anyways, so according to a 1973 Sesame Street calendar, Rubber Ducky's birthday is today, thus making it a national holiday. It's come a long way from the first concept. It was originally a chew toy for children and was first developed in the late 1800s.
Do we have any idea of why they chose a duck?
No. So apparently this manufacturing company, rubber was like a hot commodity, and they were like outproducing numerous toys and dolls, and one of them was the rubber duck. It wasn't patented, though, until 1928. And then fun little fact for you here, in 1992, our cargo ship was actually carrying an assortment of vinyl toys, and descending into the Pacific, nearly 29,000 toys, including rubber ducks, were left bobbing and drifting away into the ocean. And it took like years for them to all wash ashore in Hawaii, Maine, Seattle, and all over the place.
Now, Brittany, you're leaving out the fact that Rubber Ducky is the one, and he makes bath time lots of
fun. He is the best friend of Ernie and a close confidant to Big Bird. And I bet you're wondering, how should you honor or observe National Rubber Ducky Day?
It seems like a limited opportunity, but sure, go ahead.
All right. Well, spend time with your favorite rubber ducky. Share photos of your rubber ducky collection and discover all the different kinds of rubber duckies available.
In Amsterdam, there is a store that sells only rubber ducks. We actually have a rubber duck that says Amsterdam on it.
Oh, good for you.
As a souvenir. Oh, that's so funny.
There's a rubber duck store in Amsterdam.
Can anybody here talk like Donald Duck?
No, but I bet you can.
See, that's what I can do. I can make the noise, but I can't make any speech.
Your turn, Brittany.
No, I'm okay. No,
okay. Rubber ducks. Terry, go ahead.
Hey, Brian, I think Donald Duck did the Disco Duck sounding effect on that song, didn't he?
I don't know if he did or not. I think Rick Dees did it. But
well, Rick Dees did the song. Yeah, well, I guess. But similar sound. But anyway, that's not what I'm calling about. You're talking about Britney's laugh?
Yes.
No insult, Britney. I love your laugh. But it reminds me of the laugh. You know that song by Def Leppard, Rock of Ages? At the end of the song, there's that laugh that goes.
Ah, yes.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yep.
It kind of sounds similar to that.
It does, as a matter of fact. That's a very good point.
Yeah, so that's why I thought I'd call it. About. Don't take this as an insult, Brittany. I love your laugh.
There you go.
I just thought I'd put it out there.
See, that's thanks,
guys.
All right, thanks, Terry.
My confidence level just went through the roof.
As it should. As it should. Mike can do a Donald Duck impression. Impress away, Mike. That is very, very, very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I need you to get a little bit closer and say, you're listening to Brian Burke on City News 570 as loud as you can.
Okay, you are listening to Brian Burke on 570.
Okay, that's very good. We shall save that for a promo.
I'm so happy to hear that.
And by the way, you will get the usual rate you get from Rogers Radio, which is virtually nothing. Of course, you're a duck. You can send me the bill. Hey! I did it. All right, thanks, Mike. Go. Kyle, follow that.
I can't at all. Hey, Highway 6 between Guelph and Hamilton on the left-hand side if you're going towards Hamilton. I'm not sure if it's the same duck. But it's the same size duck that they put in the Lake Ontario a few years ago.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
there
he
over
did
the
tour.
It was there over the summer. I think he's gone now. But there was some attraction along the highway there. You could see this huge. It had to have been four stories tall. At least.
Is it still there? You said it's gone.
I think it's gone now, Kyle.
Yeah.
Oh, is it gone? Oh, okay. Anyways, I just wanted to give that. I thought that was pretty cool.
It probably went south with the rest of the ducks.
Oh my.
Jody, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to tell you, Brian, that sometimes when I'm in a good mood instead of a bad mood, I'll actually sing the Rubber Ducky song from Sesame Street.
Sing it!
Do it! Well, you better be in a good mood because you're going to sing it now. Go.
Oh, Rubber Ducky, you're the one. You make bath time so much fun. Rubber Ducky, you're the one for me.
There we go.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jody.
Thanks. You're welcome.
Again, as the winner of today's talent competition, Jody will also receive absolutely nothing because that's the prizage that we give out around here.
As two of my favorite radio hosts used to say, you will win nothing and you will enjoy it.
You will be happy. It's the Great Reset, except the radio version of it. We celebrate today, by the way, one of the most prolific songwriters in history. That, of course, Jolene, written by Dolly Parton, that's actually being covered by, of all people in the world, the White Stripes.
Okay.
A little bit different. Dolly is 75 years old. She has been given three more certificates from the Guinness World Records people.
Parts of her are 75 years old.
Yeah, other parts slightly less. Her three new Guinness World Records. I'm trying to keep abreast of the news here. Most number one hits on the Hot Country Charts, 25. She's had 25 number one hits on the Hot Country Charts. Most hits on the charts in general, 109.
Wow.
And this is a remarkable stat. Most decades on the Hot Country Charts, 7. Seven decades. She first charted in 1967.
Now, this is for an individual, I guess?
Yeah.
Because the Rolling Stones would be longer than that, but they're obviously...
Oh, would they? She charted in the 60s. Did the Stones chart before that?
I don't know. Did they?
I don't think so.
I got to look this up.
So she first charted in 1967, then again last year. And by the way, this is not charting with old music. This is charting with new music. She charted again last year with a couple of duets with Reba McEntire and Michael Bublé. Both Jolene and I Will Always Love You are among the most covered songs of all time. For those who didn't know, Dolly Parton wrote I Will Always Love You. And no one really knows the answer to the question, who has written the most songs? But Parton has written more than 5,000.
Wow.
Obviously for some other people as well.
Oh, yeah, all kinds of other people as well. Now, McCartney, they say, has written about 1,000 songs, but of course he had a whole pile that were enormous hits.
Yeah, only two of them good. Hey, now.
Anti-Beatle person over there.
No, listen. Whoa. No, I love the Beatles. George Harrison's the best. Never cared for Paul McCartney's, particularly his solo stuff.
Yeah, well, Prince, by the way, his family says there are hundreds of songs that they pulled out of his Purple Castle in Minnesota after he passed on that still haven't been released. But 5,000 songs.
That's really impressive.
I know, and she's still doing it today at 75 years old, and or as Pauly has rightfully pointed out, parts of her are 75 years old. And, but, you know, she does seem like I look at celebrities sometimes, and I don't believe much of them, but mm-hmm. she kind of seems like a really decent person. She's another person I'd put on my list to have a beer with.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fun.
Oh, definitely. I would love to meet her.
I think she'd be very entertaining.
Yeah.
Now, my wife met Tammy Wynette once, and she that was a bit disappointing to her. But then Tammy was near the end at that point, and she wasn't doing that well. But she's always had a huge Dolly Parton thing. But she has three more records, the Guinness World Records people. None of them related to the parts that you're thinking about, which is kind of interesting. Wonder how that worked out. This is Kitchener Today on Sydney News 570. We mentioned Dolly Parton, who gets three more Guinness World Records. She has charted in every decade of the last seven. That, from what I can figure out, now it could be inaccurate because it's hard to find this stuff on a moment's notice. That kind of ties her with George Jones, who did the same thing. And apparently, and I'm questioning the veracity of this too, but there's only one artist who's had a number one hit in each of five decades.
Yeah. Okay, is this person still alive?
I think so, yep.
Okay. And it's an individual, right? Not
yes.
a band? Is it Bob Dylan?
No, it's Cher.
Really?
I know. I thought that was odd, too. But if you go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, she had that disco phase for a while.
Right.
She did that, right? So she is apparently the only one who's done that. It's hard to maintain a number one in every decade because life passes you by, right? So not even Michael Jackson did that. Of course, Jackson dominated more in the 80s than any other time.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, Cher, who I can't stand. No reason.
I don't mind Cher.
I got no time for it. It sounds like somebody who's squeezing a sound out of a cat to me, which...
She was the first artist to be heavily auto-tuned.
Was she?
We hear a lot. Yeah, her, was it Believe, I think,
oh,
that
yeah.
song? From what, 19...
That one?
That was okay. The first song to be heavily auto-tuned, and music has not been the same since.
Yeah. that's very true. Of course, she had hits, but I don't think they were number one with Sonny. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that ever went to number one.
Even I Got You, Babe?
It might have been number three.
All right.
I'd have to look that up, but I don't think it made it to number one. Bands don't last that long. Although funny, if you look at like the number one touring acts these days, they're generally people from a long time ago. Even as recently as two or three years ago, Neil Diamond was one of the highest grossing concert acts. So now, last 2 years, we don't have a whole lot of data on that, do we? But I don't know. I think here's one of those things that I think Dolly Parton is one of those underappreciated performers. From what I've heard, read and talked to people, always puts on a really good show, works hard out there, has 5,000 songs to choose from,
yeah,
so that comes
go.
In handy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And as I've always maintained, the best concert I ever saw in person was Garth Brooks.
Yeah, I think I've heard you mention
guys
that.
Out there for 2.5 hours.
Without a break or anything?
Generally, but you only took a break when his wife came out for a while.
Wow, okay, yeah, yeah.
And then
Trisha Yearwood.
Yeah, and then he came back again. The guy worked incredibly hard.
Wow.
And yeah, it's well worth going to see that show. As opposed to others, which I think when you get to them a little bit later in their careers, it can be more than a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, because they're not what they were.
You right.
Know, Donny Osmond is not what he once was, I've heard, but he's still out there performing.
Still out there. Well, Willie Nelson. We saw Willie Nelson a few years ago at Casinorama, I want to say about 4 years ago, because my wife had always wanted to see him. He could still really play the guitar, but he had no clue what most of the words were. So, but he was still out there.
Yeah.
And actually, he's in another one of those people who's on the list for years and years and years and years and years. Coming up a little bit later on this afternoon, we started this article in the conversation today, and it always amazes me as time goes by how people complain about kids today. Kids today are terrible. Kids, and we've been making the same complaints. My parents made the same complaints about me. I'm pretty sure that their parents made the same complaints about them, but this dates back thousands and thousands of years, and now we have some anthropological evidence of that. So, you see, this will give you even more ammunition against your children, which I think is incredibly valuable to have. Also, we will talk with Dave Korzynski of the Angus Reid Institute survey that they have just published in the last day or so. Says 55% of us figure we're going to get infected with Omicron regardless of what we do, and about 40% would end all restrictions. It's probably interesting to see the way the landscape has changed over the past little while. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. If you have a dog, in most municipalities, you're supposed to have a license. Of course, the very badly kept secret is an awful lot of people don't have a license for their dog. City of Kitchener bylaw officers are going around issuing reminders that you should get that license. Gloria McNeil is the director of bylaw enforcement with the City of Kitchener, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Gloria.
Good afternoon.
Sending officers door to door to remind people of their dog licensing necessities, is that something new?
It's something that we have been doing for the last four seasons. So we have we've got some staff that we have on contract for snow and ice, and when they are not able to do those inspections, then we utilize them to do a door knock program for dog licensing.
So, like, when there isn't any snow or ice, go out and ask people about their dogs, right?
Exactly, yes.
Why do we license dogs? This is one of those things, Gloria, that I know we've been doing for years, and sometimes I wonder if that's the reason we do it, just because we always have.
Right. So dog licensing really is the key piece of identification that helps to reunite you with your dog. So it's, you know, immediately visible to anyone who finds them, excuse me, and is the best way to get your dog home safely and quickly and require less time to be spent at a shelter. So, you know, by getting an annual license, it allows people to keep their information updated. And then if your dog should get out or is involved in any sort of an emergency, we have a quick way to locate the owner of that dog and get them to them.
Do we have even, this is one of those things that's hard to quantify, do we have even the slightest idea how many dogs there are in Kitchener?
We don't. We anticipate that the number far exceeds how many are licensed, but we don't really have a way to quantify that.
And the problems that the City of Kitchener have are no different than every other municipality that has a dog license in that generally people don't license their dogs. So I take from that either people are incredibly cheap or they don't see the value in it.
And I think it's a little bit of everything. I do know that often we come across people who genuinely didn't know and are more than happy to, you know, to comply and get that license. But I agree. I do think there are people who, you know, don't believe in it or, you know, think it's a money grab and will avoid it as long as they can.
Now, the revenue that comes from dog licenses, where does it go?
The revenue that comes from dog licenses goes to several things. So there's programs with the Humane Society, including medical. If a dog is picked up or an animal is picked up and needs immediate medical attention before we can find an owner. And it honestly goes to help offset our contract with the Humane Society. So there is that offset there as well for us from a economic standpoint.
So we don't know how many dogs there actually might be in the city, and I guess we're probably never going to know that. Do we know how many dogs are turned in as strays at the Humane Society?
I don't have that information off the top of my head, but that's certainly something that I could provide back.
And so the question that I often get on this, Gloria, is, okay, dogs, they can be returned because they run off. Then why don't we license cats?
Yeah, so we get that question often. I mean, licensing of cats is something that comes up from time to time. It's not something that we're currently looking at right now, but, you know, I think the two big things that stand out for us is that if people are following the bylaw requirements, then cats are supposed to remain indoors at all times. So generally, cats aren't to be outside, and you know, enforcing that or knowing whether somebody owns a cat or not is quite difficult. So, you know, if we go to somebody's door and ring the bell, your dog may bark. Cats don't do the same thing or don't run to the door. So, you know, the enforcement piece of that would be a bit challenging. The other piece of that is we often will get complaints about feral or wild cats, and you know, those are not owned by anybody. So that, you know, a licensing program would really be ineffective for those types of situations.
I would imagine we have more of a problem with feral cats than we have feral dogs, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I've often wondered why that is, but that's a discussion for another day. So, like, we have a dog. We're in Waterloo, so you can't come and get us. But our dog is microchipped. So, obviously, if she ever gets away from the couch, which is never going to happen, she'd be pretty easy to find. All you have to do is scan the microchip. So, I guess the question for some people would be, why on an annual basis then?
Yeah, so, I mean, that is something that I have seen some municipalities looking at reviewing microchipping versus licensing. So, you know, the only thing that I don't have a lot of information on that because that's not something we have actively looked at, but I do know that one of the challenges that I've heard from the Humane Society is that once an animal is microchipped, it's not very often that owners will keep their information updated with that the company that microchips them. So often that information is outdated if people have moved or if they've changed a number and then it's no longer relevant.
So we have to go back to what the real problem is, which is responsible pet ownership.
Exactly.
So if you're going to have a pet and you move, maybe update the information somewhere.
Right.
I've had some people contact me, Gloria, and say that law enforcement officers are peering in windows and trying to find out if people have dogs. I'm assuming that could happen. I'm just wondering if that's actually something that you want people to do.
So we absolutely do not want that. And in fact, you know, with the current climate we're in with COVID, staff are under very strict instructions when doing door knock programs. So we do have, we have published a pamphlet with the Humane Society that talks about responsible pet ownership, and licensing information is included in that. So staff are basically going door to door. If somebody is home and we can have a conversation, they've been instructed to maintain 2 meters or 6 feet at all times, and just share that information with them. We are encouraging people to go online and purchase a dog license there, as you get a $25 gift certificate to Wren's. So, you know, really at the end of the day, your dog license would be minimal. But yes, they have been instructed. There's no reason that an officer needs to enter your home or be peering in your windows. They should be ringing the bell. If somebody's home and they can have a conversation, that's great. If not, we're simply leaving the pamphlet at the door.
Do we know at all, Gloria, and this could be outside your wheelhouse too, but do we know at all if there are other municipalities that have gone a different route in trying to do this and been more successful? Because everything that I can find out right across the board, across the country and almost everywhere, is that generally licensing doesn't really have the impact we want it to have.
Mm-hmm. So I have seen a couple of municipalities that have gone to a one-time licensing fee. So that has been done. And then I believe, if I'm correct in this, I believe it was Windsor who may have gone to a microchip and one-time licensing program, but that was very recent. So I'm not sure what the success has been with that.
Gloria, thanks for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Gloria McNeil is the Director of Bylaw Enforcement for the City of Kitchener. So yes, some bylaw enforcement officers are out and they could knock on your door and they could ask if you have a dog and they could remind you that you are supposed to technically get a license for your dog every year. I rather like the idea of, let's do this one time. Now, still, you would have a responsibility as the owner to update your ownership information so that the microchipping is still going to be effective. And I'm a great believer in being a responsible dog owner no matter what you do. So you take care of the dog, you provide all for its needs, you do not leave the dog outside for hours at a time. If you are not prepared to have the dog inside, then don't have the dog. That's where they should be spending the majority of their time. I also think, look, if you're going to license dogs, and I'm okay with the one-time license and the microchip, And if those funds are used to benefit the Humane Society, I'm okay with that. If the Humane Society is doing really important work for the municipality, then fund them properly. But I also believe that if you're going to do that one-time licensing microchipping thing with a dog, then do it with a cat, too. Because there's plenty of cats out there. How do we think the feral cats got there? At some point, that's what happened, right? Terry, go ahead.
Hey, Brian. I don't really have a problem paying for a dog license, on an annual basis if it helps to promote, programs at the Humane Society to shelter the animals that are there. Now, my situation is unique because I do have a dog. It's an older dog. It's a 16-year-old toy poodle mix. I actually shared the dog with my ex-wife because we got the dog. We were still together. But now, I know in Woodstock, they don't have a licensing program anymore. So I've had the dog now for about a year because, she's older and she's getting sick. So, she has some issues. So, and it's not going back to Kitchener. But I don't know off the top of my head if the dog was licensed last year, but it's not going to happen now, I guess. But the thing is that she was saying, well, it gets the animal back to the original owner if it goes stray. But, dogs have those tags with a phone number you can get. Or, like, my dog is microchipped, but like she was saying, unless you update your address, they're not, like, if my dog goes lost, which it's not because it doesn't leave the house anymore, but if it did, they could still track to the original Kitchener address where it was registered, so it will get found there because that's where the residence is still there, but they won't be able to find me in Woodstock if the dog goes lost in Woodstock. So, yeah, I can see that aspect of it. But if a dog does have a, like, I know Woodstock got rid of the licensing program, and I don't, like I said earlier, I think as long as it helps promote programs at the Humane Society, it's a good idea to have that. But if my dog goes lost, you can get a tag similar to a dog license. You can put your phone number on it, and they can track you that way too, right?
Yeah, yeah, very true. All right, thanks, Terry. I appreciate that because it is effective January 1st, 2022, so just less than 2 weeks ago. The city of Woodstock no longer requires you to purchase a dog tag from the city. The requirement of pet owners, it says here, to identify their dog will now be the responsibility of the pet owner, which is exactly where it should be. Each owner is to obtain their own tag with owner contact information clearly displayed or microchip your dog, which, again, let's go back, responsible pet owner, you would think you would do that. Go get a little metal tag with the dog's name and the phone number on it. And as the Woodstock bylaw continues on, says pet owners can easily purchase a personalized tag with their phone number printed on it online at a local pet store, obtain a tag from their vet, or have their animal microchipped in order to meet the new requirements. Now, is there a punishment? Doesn't appear to be in this. So it's encouraging responsible dog ownership. Murray, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because it just reminded me that I need to get my dog's tag again here, right?
Okay. Are your dogs microchipped, Murray?
Just one. I just got one.
Okay.
His name is Rupert, chocolate lab, beautiful dog. But yeah, he's microchipped. I've had tags on him every year since I've got him. He's four and a half now. So I don't do it so much for the finding him because I know the microchip will do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I do it for is what the woman said, that the money goes in to help other animals that don't have it as good as my dog does. But it's going to cost me $40 for the regular tag. So, like, what's that? A big bag of dog food and a rawhide or two?
Man, that's true.
My dog, he gets those like crazy. He gets he's so spoiled rotten, man. But I think about all the other animals that don't get it as good as him that could use some help. Thanks, right. Brian.
Thanks, Maria. And now, ultimately, I guess in my perfect world, if we had responsible pet ownership everywhere, we wouldn't need a place like the Humane Society, right? Maybe we'd still have to deal with feral cats and things like that. But if we had responsible dog ownership and pet ownership, then I think that situation would probably change when it came to cats. There is this tendency for a lot of people to allow their cats to go outdoors. Ours does not. Never in all the years that we've had a cat, which dates a long, long time, we've never allowed our cats to wander around outside because they will run off. They will disappear. Now, we've had one get out and disappear for like a week and a half, and then it's found its way back eventually. But they can survive out there quite nicely. Dogs, look, we could leave our dog outside for a week, and it probably wouldn't move more than 10 feet from us, because it has recognized it lives in the complete and utter lap of luxury and has no desire to go out and survive on her own. But she is microchipped, and she is, you know, well taken care of, and she has a tag on her where you can identify her name and the number. It'll find all the information that you need. So she has all of that going on, but some owners don't do that. And do we have a system where we could fix that? I think Woodstock's gone in the right direction. I don't think you should be paying an annual fee. One-time fee, way you go. Maybe there's a fee to maintain the microchip system. I don't know how much that costs. But the idea of just having an annual fee, it's not a money grab because the money's going off to the Humane Society, which, as our caller Murray says, does some good work. But if we're having as big a problem with stray cats, feral cats, if you will, maybe even a bigger problem than we are with stray dogs and feral dogs, maybe cat owners should be paying part of the freight too, right? Or find another way to fund the work of the Humane Society, or eliminate the work of the Humane Society, which would be an even better idea. *570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. Now, I had some people tell me that by law enforcement officers were peering through windows in an effort to find out if you have a dog. Gloria says that is, it may be happening, but it's certainly not supposed to. They may ring your doorbell, and that, of course, as we know, is generally a trigger for every dog to light it up. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
I have seen some municipalities looking at reviewing microchipping versus licensing. I do know that one of the challenges that I've heard from the Humane Society is that once an animal is microchipped, it's not very often that owners will keep their information updated with that the company that microchips them.
Who let the dogs out?
Hoot, hoot, hoot.
Gloria McNeil, who is the head of bylaw enforcement for the city of Kitchener. Yes, some enforcement officers are out and about knocking on doors, reminding you that you need to get a dog license. These are repurposed bylaw enforcement officers from near as we can figure. Usually might be focused on things like ice and snow along the sidewalk, but since there hasn't been a whole lot of that lately, I guess they're spending some extra time looking around for dogs that are unlicensed. Now, the city of Kitchener said it had about 13,000 dog licenses that were purchased a couple of years ago. Last year, that dropped to about 11,500, despite the general belief that more people picked up some dogs to deal with the pandemic. Different places handle this quite differently. In Woodstock, as Terry pointed out, there is no dog license system anymore. They got rid of that. Now, if your dog is picked up and you don't have tags on it, ID tags, you could face a fine. Now, that could be difficult when you go to pick up the dog, if perhaps it was picked up by the animal shelter in Woodstock and it's not, you don't have an identification tag on it, you could face a fine for that. But they are putting the onus for identifying and keeping pets safe right exactly where it should be, which is on top of the pet owner. But there is no pet license in the city of Woodstock. Of course, in the city of Kitchener, there is. Those licenses can range anywhere from $34.50 for a new sterilized dog to about $68 for an unsterilized dog. If you miss the expiry date, of course, you have to pay more. None of these changes, like reducing the fees for sterilized dogs or putting a penalty in after a certain date, not much of it has really moved the needle in terms of getting more people to license their dogs. And I've always maintained that's because a lot of people feel there's no value to it. You want to talk about licensing cats? Well, if Paul Harriet, who owns 14 cats, if he goes to Toronto, he would be paying for his cats because there are license fees in the city of Toronto. If it's spayed or neutered, which if you have a house cat, it should be, $15. And if it's not spayed or neutered, it's $50 in the city of Toronto. I don't know how successful their cat licensing program is.
Well, our cats are inside in the neighborhood we live in. They have to be because there's coyotes in our neighborhood.
That's a very effective cat reduction strategy.
Yeah, and you can hear them howling at night. It's sometimes they're right behind our house. It's crazy.
But you've had cats. Have you ever had a cat that was like, people like to call it this, an outdoor cat?
When I was a kid, our family cat was an outdoor cat for the last few years of her life. She was indoors and then, you know, like most cats, they'll escape from time to time. And then she always came back. And we're like, all right, let's just let her out. And so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows what she's up to?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll be doing all kinds. Now, was the cat fixed?
Yes.
See, I'm not overly concerned about it if the cat's out and it's fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not out there creating more cats. And cats breed like rabbits.
Yeah.
And they really do. So, but in Toronto, they've done it. How successful has it been? I don't know. I don't even think that they know. Because if we don't know how many dogs there are, and we don't, we sure as hell don't know how many cats there are.
Yeah, there's like a bylaw officer, if they see the cat peering out the window, will they knock on the door to see the light? Like,
in Toronto, maybe. Yeah, possibly.
Cats
are known to sit in the windows, right?
Dogs,
and watch people
go
by.
They love the windows, yeah.
They do like that. Dogs, of course, just run at the sound of a doorbell, which ours will definitely do, and just launch. Other than that, she's really, really good. But it's $15 for a spayed cat in Toronto, $50 for an unspayed or unneutered. So a cat that is intact, as they like to say in the veterinary business. I think it's fair to do one or the other, but I would let's get away from the licenses. And if the work that the Humane Society is doing is really worthwhile, then city of whomever funds the work of the Humane Society. Really pretty simple. Now, and to Murray's point that he doesn't mind because he knows that the fees that he pays goes to take care of animals who don't have the same care, well, all animals should have the same care. And if you're not prepared to invest that time and attention in your pet, then don't get a pet. It's really simple. And I realize that sometimes people find themselves in somewhat difficult situations where they decided to get a dog and they had difficulty training it and that became an issue and all of a sudden the dog's outside all the time. Or I've certainly met people who have, you know, got a dog and the idea was the kids will take care of it. Well, kids lie about that. They generally tend not to take care of it, certainly if they're at a certain age.
Oh, yeah, I'll take it for walks. I'll feed them. Please, Mom.
Yeah. The place I live in, right there, that woman said, we get a cat, I'll change the litter. It happened once. That was 11 years ago.
That's a one stinky litter box.
Because then it fell to me. No, I'll get a cat. I'll change litter. Now, to her credit, when we got the dog, I wasn't around a whole lot because I was working out of town for a while. And she said, I'll train the dog. I'll take care of it. And she's been very good about that, although she does technically not take the dog for a walk between November and May because she doesn't like walking the dog in the cold. All right. This is a price I get to pay. And I don't mind taking her out for a walk because it gets me out and moving around as well. I'd really like to see us have a discussion about if we're continuing this dog licensing system because it's what we've always done, that's the wrong reason to do things. If it actually does provide something, and if you can actually get people to sign on so that we would hopefully have fewer stray dogs and fewer stray cats, that would be worthwhile. But I'm not sure we're doing any of that. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
You're like the independent network news on Channel 9. Everywhere that you go, no matter where you are at, I said you talk about this and you talk about that. You talk too much.
After 2 years of this, whatever this happens to be, as everything morphs and changes and moves along, after 2 years of this, I do sincerely hope that we learn something. We learn something about, well, all kinds of things, like maybe the way we interact with people, maybe how we build our cities, maybe how we define our cities. Kate Choi, an associate professor of sociology at Western University, writing in the conversation, talks about how inclusion and walkability will be key factors to building, she says, rebuilding cities after the COVID-19 pandemic. And Kate joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Kate.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm always interested in looking forward a little bit on these things to see what we can do. And much of the focus here in Southern Ontario over the last few years has been building up and not out, which of course increases population density, which I think a lot of people have the idea that, well, population density obviously has an impact on pandemic spread. So is population density a problem or a solution or both?
So it depends on the neighborhood income levels. So what our study showed was that population density contributed to the faster spread of COVID-19 in low-income neighborhoods, but it did not have such an impact in high-income neighborhoods. And the reason for this had to do with the fact that high-rises in low-income neighborhoods probably have poorer ventilation systems, whereas in high-income neighborhoods, they tend to have good air ventilation systems as well as staff to disinfect common areas. So what our findings suggest is that even if there is high population density, if it is in fact the case that we invest towards better air ventilation systems, it may actually not have a negative impact on the health of its residents.
Why is walkability important?
Walkability is important because it allows individuals to be able to run errands on foot in a relatively short amount of time. So in terms of in the setting of COVID-19, people were able to run their errands on foot with relative ease, which reduced their exposure to the COVID-19 virus. And as a result, irrespective of the neighborhood income levels, we saw that COVID-19 spread at a much slower rate in neighborhoods that were highly walkable. But nonetheless, improving neighborhood walkability seemed to be much more beneficial for the residents of low-income neighborhoods.
Years and years and years ago, Kate, neighborhoods were much more walkable. We got away from that because I think we became largely very car-centric. So that's a place that we can go, I guess, back to the future with?
I think in the future, and particularly after the pandemic, we have to build more sustainable neighborhoods. And part of that may entail building more walkable neighborhoods, increasing the amount of green spaces, and reducing the share of overcrowded households in our neighborhood.
And there needs to be more of a focus on income levels in neighborhoods, right? Because if we do the same thing in every neighborhood, it doesn't always work out the same way because of income disparities.
You're absolutely right. What we are finding is that the impact that the physical environment of neighborhoods have on the health of the residents, and in this case, which is expressed as the pace with which COVID-19 spread, differed vastly across low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods. And that was because residents of low-income neighborhoods tend to rely more heavily on community resources because they have fewer personal resources at their disposal. Furthermore, there's also prior work has also shown that the quality of neighborhood amenities present in low-income neighborhoods tend to be of poor quality. For example, in terms of sidewalks, they tend to be less well-maintained, and they tend to have more graffiti and litter in them. So it's really important to prioritize low-income neighborhoods and the neighborhood amenities in these neighborhoods when we are seeking to rebuild after the pandemic.
So things like pandemics put pressure on everything, and pressure tends to reveal the cracks, and that's really what's happened over the last couple of years.
You're absolutely right. COVID-19 has amplified existing social inequality among individuals who are advantaged and disadvantaged, and this includes the residents of lower and higher income neighborhoods.
Now, it does seem to me that we have been moving, albeit slowly, towards more sustainable neighborhoods, haven't we?
So there is, historically, there has been a pattern of building more greener spaces, as well as changing our cities so that they tend to be more bike-friendly and more walkable. And we need to continue our trajectory towards those neighborhoods.
It's hard to do, though, with a continuing shift towards urban living and the pressure to squeeze as many people into a square mile as we can.
You're absolutely right. One of the things that we were consistently seeing across our findings and across neighborhoods with different levels of income was the case that the share of overcrowded households significantly hastened the spread of COVID-19. And over the past few decades, soaring real estate prices contributed to the rise in overcrowded households. So we really need to think about a little bit more about how to include green spaces, how to turn neighborhoods to be more walkable.
And that seems to be a very difficult question. How do we deal with the overcrowding in urban centers without creating the sprawl that nobody really seems to want?
You're absolutely right. I don't think that there is an easy solution to it, but I do think that we need to heavily invest resources to try to achieve more walkable neighborhoods with more green spaces. We also need to invest a lot more heavily on things like ventilation systems in the event that there is, in fact, crowding. And I think that such an investment is crucial, particularly after the pandemic, because there is a very strong need for us to build sustainable cities. And what COVID-19 has revealed is that it is extremely important for our well-being and health to build such cities.
And in your article, you suggest that it's not enough just to say, all right, this template's going to fit everywhere we go. We need to take specific neighborhoods into account, right?
That is absolutely right. I don't think that when we rebuild after the pandemic, we can just use a one-size-fits-all approach. After all, the needs that the residents of low, middle, and high-income neighborhoods have differ significantly. Their ability to use personal resources to meet their needs will also differ significantly. So public health officials, as well as urban planners, have to understand what are the diverse needs of residents of the different cities and design a plan that fits their diverse needs and rebuild a city taking into account that needs will be different.
So urban planners and public health officials will be out there wrestling with politicians and developers. It sounds like it should be fun.
I hope that it's a fun process to achieve a sustainable city.
Kate, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Kate Joy joins us from Western University. She is in sociology at Western, just down the road in London, suggesting we need to have a better look at, well, start with the neighborhoods and how they look. And in her piece, which she does along with Patrick Dennis, who is an associate professor of sociology at Western, talks about how low-income neighborhoods can differ from high-income neighborhoods, even though you might have the same population density, but perhaps the building in the lower-income neighborhood has less efficient ventilation, maybe has fewer staff on site to perhaps do cleaning, et cetera, stuff like that. And the whole walkability factor, getting people to get out and move around and separate from bigger sidewalks, all of those different things to create just a better sense of a walkable neighborhood. One of the great advantages of living in Uptown Waterloo is it is a very walkable neighborhood. I can walk for almost anything. There is very little that I can't walk for, which is great. That's why my car will often sit for 4, 5, 6 days at a time because I quite simply don't need to take it out. Some of the other neighborhoods that we've lived in town, now we used to live just around the corner here in Westvale, and as you come up University past Fisher Hallman towards Ira Needles, you'll see the Food Basics over on the left. If you look over on the right, that's the Westvale neighborhood, and you will see a walking path that goes into the neighborhood. We used to live right on that court, so we could walk straight across, and often did, over to Food Basics, which was there at the time that we lived there, and could do a variety. We even went to a video store. That's how long ago we lived there. But it made for a very walkable neighborhood. But if you go to other parts of Westvale, that's not the case at all. If you go into the middle of Westvale, you'd be walking for days to get anywhere. And other parts of the city were the same way. We were in Northwest Waterloo, where technically you can walk, but it is an awful long hike. And the reality was that if we wanted to go perhaps to a grocery store or a drugstore or something else like that, we would have to take the car, quite simply because the walk was not going to happen. Even in this coldest weather of this time, I can bundle up, I can hook up the dog, and I can walk to get pretty much anything I need. There's a grocery store, there's an LCBO, there's 1,000 cannabis stores, haven't had to go to them yet, and there's a hardware store that will allow me to get pretty much whatever I need. And not all neighborhoods are like that, and they need to get more like that. Now, some of the older suburban neighborhoods, that creates a bit of a problem. Forest Heights is interesting because they've got more than a few little plazas in there that kind of serves as a neighborhood center, but others are just a maze of one street to another street to a court. And really, if you want to do anything, you got to get into the car and drive. And City of Kitchener is changing in the downtown area. Many people will decry that they don't have all of the services that they need. Well, those will come eventually. But what we did in the past is we would build up the downtown areas and kind of forget you needed a little bit more green space, which will be the next step forward. Star 570-570-2545, 1-800-570-5715. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Population density contributed to the faster spread of COVID-19 in low-income neighborhoods, but it did not have such an impact in high-income neighborhoods. And the reason for this had to do with the fact that high-rises in low-income neighborhoods probably have poorer ventilation systems.
Kate Choi, sociology professor at Western University, saying when we get out of this and we get back to the idea of developing our cities, which obviously here in the region we're doing an awful lot of developing of cities, having a look at the way our cities are built or planned might have an impact in terms of the way things are spread, and down the road there will be other diseases of some type, and maybe that's just one more thing you can do that reduces risk and also makes it a better place to live, which is a good idea. Walter, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing that I've noticed, that any of these new housing projects that I see out and around, like you can barely walk in between the houses. I look at the eavesdrops and they're like a foot apart. You know, like these houses in these new subdivisions are like 40 feet wide and like really tall, and like I don't find those kind of neighborhoods appealing at all. And you know, like they're, and it's like you were saying, like they just try to jam as many people in on an acre of land as possible. And these, and I don't know who it is at the city that is actually okaying these kind of projects, right? You know, like to go ahead. I mean, it's perfect for the, like the guy that's building them, right? Like he's getting like $1 million a house now, and you know, so I don't know if that's why the city is looking at it like that. I mean, it's been going on for a while. It's just gotten up to that dollar value here recently, but I just find it really ugly. I think those neighborhoods are completely ugly, and that's what I think.
I get it, Walter. They're certainly not what they used to be when you had 50 and 60 and 70-foot wide lots. Now you're down to 30 feet, which is really essentially enough to jam a 24-foot wide house in. And yes, they do tend to build up and not out because, well, because you put as many homes as you can within reason on a piece of land. And It's the pressure of trying to find more places for more people. That dream of a single family place with a little bit of yard is still a pretty big dream for a lot of people. That's that indication that you are, you know, moving along the path that you want. But it certainly has changed, you know, over the years in terms of new builds. Actually, if you even go down to this old neighborhood of ours in Westvale, And it started building at a certain point in the, I believe it was in the late 70s or very, very, very early 80s. And then there was a slowdown. So construction in that area stopped. And then it restarted again. And I think we got that house in 84. It was when we moved into that place on Ashby Court in Waterloo. And it was on the very bottom of a court. And it had a very wide lot. It's probably 60 to 70 feet wide. A couple of hundred feet deep. Huge lots. Now, we didn't have much of a backyard because the house is really pushed way back on the lot, but certainly plenty of space. And then we moved to another place up in the Columbia and Herbsville Road area. Big difference 20 years later with the size of the lot. Generally, you weren't going to get a lot that was more than 100 feet deep. And I think the lots were around 35 feet wide, so not a whole lot of space. I do remember this from our house on Ashby, is that the driveway alone was 62 feet long. So we could easily jam three or four cars into that driveway. Now, was it a particularly efficient use of space? I'd argue probably not. Like today, if you were developing that same street, I believe at the time there were 37 houses on that street. Today, you would probably put 60 houses on that street without much of an issue. Just simply because we don't have the space. We don't want to take up the farmland. There's a hard border around the city of Waterloo. And that's not going to change anytime in the near future. So you start to do exactly what Walter talked about. You limit the size of the lot. You build up. So you build a lot of taller places, which at times make you think that they might want to topple over, but they never seem to. So I guess they're doing a pretty good job on that. But it's going to continue to be walkability. To me, you can still have walkability in that kind of a neighborhood. You just need to have the places to walk to. If you get too far, we often hear you at Waterloo City Council about the last 800 meters. That seems to be about the number that people are willing to walk. Now, whether they're willing to walk when it's minus 20, different question than whether they're willing to walk when it's 25 degrees out. But that last 800 meters is always kind of the sticking point. So that's why you'll find in, you know, a lot of places, let's take the Ion, for example, if you have a station, you know, within 800 meters of there, you'll see a considerable amount of residential development because that's where people want to be in terms of walkability to that Ion station. And it goes for everything else. If the grocery store is 1.6 kilometers away, you are way more likely to walk to it if it's 800 meters away. We're human beings. That's what we do, right? Coming up on the other side, we talked to Dave Krasinski from the Angus Reid Institute. It probably comes as no surprise that there is a level of resignation to the reality of Omicron, that at some point you're probably going to come down with it. Or maybe you've already had it. I know there are certainly people in that situation. Given the symptoms that it presents, et cetera, maybe you've already gone through it. But their latest poll says, yep, there's a fair amount of inevitability to that. And then there's an interesting discussion on how people feel about the restrictions. And it probably won't surprise you to know that some of those feelings are different if you have been vaccinated or unvaccinated. And it won't surprise you, certainly didn't surprise me, to see the results of that. But more and more, there's a push, right? Maybe not surprising, 2 years into it, that we're starting to see that. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Pick a little, talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, chip, 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 talk a lot, pick a little more, pick a little, talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, chip, 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 talk a lot, pick a little more, pick a little, talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, chip, 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 talk a lot, pick a little more, pick a little, talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, chip, 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 chip. Professor, her kind of woman doesn't...
Probably no surprise after a couple of years of this that it starts to wear on people. If you can take anything, I think, from a new Angus Reid survey of people's feelings on, well, a number of different things, you can get that. Dave Krasinski is with Angus Reid, joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon, Brian. How is everything out there in Ontario?
Oh, it couldn't,
holding up okay?
It couldn't possibly be better, good Lord. If any happier, it'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a... You know, you look across the country right now, that was one of the things of writing this report. It, you know, if you're in Saskatchewan, it's just kind of, you know, day to day is pretty normal. You've obviously got the virus a concern, but people are just kind of doing their thing. And then you go to Quebec or Ontario or to a certain extent BC, and, you know, if you just got dropped out into any place, you might you know, get fined for something that you hadn't even considered, you know, 2 years ago. So it's an interesting look across the Federation these days.
Well, and you mentioned how Saskatchewan is a little different, but even then in Saskatchewan, as your poll shows, there are people who believe restrictions should be stricter.
Yeah, that's the biggest one in terms of shifts. We did this study. We like to ask this question fairly regularly because restrictions are vacillating so much. So we asked, you know, in the place where you live, do you think restrictions are pretty well where they should be? Are they too strict or are they not strict enough? What you see in Saskatchewan, where it has been a little bit laissez-faire over the course of the last couple of months, the government has been hesitant to really bring in greater restrictions. And part of the benefit of living in Saskatchewan is you're a little bit more spread out and there's a smaller population. But 44% say that the restrictions right now don't go far enough. They'd like to see the government do more. And that's up 19 points from December 20th. So that's the highest mark in the country. Whereas if you look at Ontario, the percentage who think that they don't go far enough has actually dropped 11 points as restrictions have become a little bit stricter. 37%, so the largest group by a very small margin, think that the government has struck the right balance. And one in three think that they go too far. So in Ontario, it's basically a third each way. So people really have three different minds about what to do about this. And that's what makes it so challenging for governments, because it's a moving target, and it's really hard to satisfy everybody with the level of restriction and care that they're getting.
Well, and what strikes me on that, Dave, is we know how we often talk about how difficult it is to find a consensus in this country about a whole long list of issues. And this is just an incredible example of how, in many ways, evenly split we are. So the consensus is even harder to find.
Yeah, it really is. And when you go a little step further, one of the things, the angles that we took on this study that we haven't done before, is there's that contingent of the population that say, okay, it's time to just do away with restrictions and let everybody take responsibility for themselves, which is inherently, I think, a little bit of a flawed argument in that it's not an issue that is about personal responsibility. It's kind of about community responsibility. It's very hard for somebody to anticipate their contact with somebody who is more at risk, and the kind of escalating way in which your contact turns into somebody else's contact and just keeps going ad infinitum until the virus gets tired, I guess. So we asked that question, though, and said, do you think that it's time to just end restrictions? And for a certain group of the population, 39% say that they're actually supportive of that. It is very divisive from place to place. So you're not going to go to anywhere in the country and really find more than 50% of people saying that. You might anticipate the place that has the highest level of anti-lockdown sentiment, and that's Alberta at the 50% mark. But in Ontario, 39% say, yeah, they would support that. But 56% say, no, that's not the way to go. Even though Omicron has shown that it's more of a mild strain than Delta, the fact that it is, causing so many hospitalizations because of the relative scale of the spread is really weighing in the minds of people. So 56% say, no, that's not the way to go. We've got to still have some restrictions. And then they move on to debate what those restrictions are. But it's not something that we're really getting a lot of clarity on in terms of the population agreeing that we've got to take one approach or the other. It really is a balancing act. And it's I'm glad I don't work in government right now. Over the past 2 years, I think there's been a lot of examples of government waiting too long and then paying the price for that later. And if you act too quickly, then people look at you and say, you know, the caseload is very low. Why are we, you know, closing restaurants? So it's a really tough one to win public opinion. So I think it's just about what the medical professionals feel is best and kind of living with that guidance.
And the ground has shifted a lot, I think, specifically in the last 3 or 4 months. It seems like the ground has shifted, which we're kind of seeing in that discussion on restrictions, right?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen is that there's less of a huge push to have restrictions. You know, certainly that portion of the population that think that they're necessary. But to have 39%, so basically 2 in 5, saying that they would do away with restrictions would really have been unheard of during Delta. People were much more concerned about that. You look at just the concern numbers. The concern over personal sickness has dropped quite a bit. And I think that's really the challenge, is that for a lot of people, there isn't that huge personal risk. You know, I had COVID over the holidays. My sister-in-law and her partner had it. And, you know, at no point were we really concerned for our health. It was just the, okay, now we've got to isolate for the 5 days and then do the 5 days with masks if you're going to be around people. But the symptoms really, for many people, are just so minor that it's hard to be really more concerned about it. Whereas with Delta, where you saw much more hospitalization per case, it was a little bit easier, I think, for the government to say, you know, this is really serious. Whereas people look at it now, and even though they see the cases really rising, it's not imbued with that same sense of urgency. So that's why we're seeing a little bit more of a split in the population in terms of what they want. The restrictions aren't seen as quite as necessary. And the other big data point from the study today, 55% of Canadians say that regardless of what they do, they think that they're going to contract Omicron. So there's that sense of hopelessness in terms of their own, you know, you can take your own personal responsibility, and it doesn't really matter what you do. You're just going to get it, and you're not going to know where it came from, and it might pass. You might not even notice that you had it. So there's a real sense of inevitability with this particular wave.
Yeah, I don't want to call it hopelessness, but I guess I like to term it as there seems to be a level of resignation there that wasn't there before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of people, we see parents more likely to say that. I think that's one of the really interesting things to pay attention to, is that if you have a child in school, the percentage of parents saying that they're going to get Omicron kind of no matter what they do, what precautions they take, is 10 points higher than non-parents. So there's these little pockets of public opinion that I think are really interesting in terms of what they want. And if you look at those people who say that they're going to have Omicron regardless, that it's inevitable, you know, they're very split on what they want to see with public health measures. You know, still 49% of them, so half, say that it's not time to do away with public health measures. They feel like they're going to get sick regardless, but they still want the measures in place just to try to kind of stem the spread and to keep people who might be more at risk from getting sick. So there's a real balancing act, I think, in terms of what people are expecting and then what they want governments to do.
You asked some questions about school-aged children. I found that fascinating because you really gave people three options that, you know, what should be the government's priority. One was preventing the spread of COVID-19 in the schools. The mental health and social development of kids was the other. And both aspects need to be considered equally. Preventing the spread didn't rank maybe as high as a lot of us would have thought.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you look at that data. We didn't know really what to expect, but that's been the big balancing act discussion, right? Is it's too much of a consequence to keep children out of school because of their mental health, because of the social development aspects of it, and how hard it is just to be stuck at home for days at a time when you would normally be out, you know, socializing with your friends and learning in person. The portion of parents who say that their primary concern is preventing the spread of COVID-19 is relatively low. It's 16% nationally. Interesting regional division here. In Ontario, it's actually 1 in 5, which is the highest mark among the provinces that we looked at. In Quebec, it's just 11%, and then in BC, just 7%. But the predominant feeling seems to be that we've got to balance those things. Parents essentially want their children in school. They're much more likely to say that the mental health and social development is a primary factor concern to compared to the COVID-19 spread. But the largest group do say that we've got to balance those two aspects. So I think there's some sympathy with governments who are trying to figure out what to do, and extending the delay to returning to class. But ultimately, parents really do lean toward having children in school if it can be done safely. So I think that's the biggest thing they're looking for from the school districts and from the governments is what is the plan? We've got to have a plan in place that allows kids to be in school, because, you know, the worry about just COVID-19 is not nearly as high as it is for the worry about what it means to be out of school for long periods of time. So that's something that I think is really interesting in here as well, is that parents really do lean toward that second aspect of having kids in school and doing it safely.
I would imagine that graph would have looked entirely different 2 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, is that we're entering a phase where it's almost people are learning to live with the virus. There's a question in here about, do you think 2022 will actually be the last year of the pandemic? Only 23% of Canadians think that this is the last year. So they're really looking at ways in which they can continue their lives, be safe, but have as little disruption as possible. So that's a real challenge for people who, you know, might have disabilities, might have conditions that don't allow them to go on with their life and do it while kind of balancing the risks, because the risks are so much higher. So there's a real conversation going on about how do we kind of service the majority of people who will be fine, but also balance the needs of those who might not be fine if they get sick. And that's, I think, something that 2022 is going to be really about, is balancing that. And, you know, 23% think that this is the last year, whereas most people are looking at it and saying, okay, this is going to be around for a while, so let's figure out what our strategy is.
So if you were a politician and you were looking at these results and saying, hopefully I can gather a little bit of intelligence here on perhaps a route that I can go, you really wouldn't learn a lot here, would you?
No, it'd be really tricky. I think the biggest thing is to look at other jurisdictions right now. I think Europe, in terms of their Omicron experience, is a couple of weeks ahead of us. So you can look at the peaking of numbers there and what that's looking like. And that really, the jurisdictional data gives you a nice idea of how long this is going to last. And then you can kind of cater policy by that and say that, you know, you're basing this on the best available data. That's oftentimes what people want, is just to know what the plan is and why. And I think when they get frustrated is when they see, you know, inconsistency or poor communication or plans that maybe just seem like they're not really based in reality, which we have certainly seen in some provinces over the course of 2 years. It's been a real mixed bag. So I think that's the biggest thing, is that people really just want to know what they're doing and why. It would be hard to look at the public opinion data and figure that out. I think you'd be better looking at the jurisdictional data and the public health data and trying to figure out what the best source of our course of action is.
Dave, thanks for your time.
No problem, Brian, anytime.
Dave Krasinski from the Angus Reid Institute, their newest survey, which it shows a very sticky landscape for those who would be running for office. Kevin, go ahead.
Hello, hi. I just want to share with everybody my experience. I've been double vaccinated with Pfizer. And last week, my daughter and my wife, they had symptoms. So they booked an appointment to go to the drive-through test facilities on Charles Street.
Yeah.
So my daughter, even though I had absolutely no symptoms, nothing whatsoever, I was healthy as I always. And my daughter insisted, you know, that, you know, since we're going, you should have a test too. I said, fine, no problem. So we went, and the same night we received our result, and to my shock and surprise, I was positive. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I had no fever, no body ache, no coughing, nothing, like healthy as a horse. Anyway, so for 5 days I did a self-isolation, and I was in contact with the Ministry of Health. So after the 5 days, they said, now you can go back. Anyway, just to make the longest story short, even as of today, I still have nothing. The only thing that showed that I have COVID was just a test. So what I was thinking is, how many millions of people are out there like me with no symptoms? And if my daughter would have insisted, I wouldn't even have got tested because I had no symptoms. So how complicated is this? I don't know if it was Omicron. It was, I don't know what kind was it. They didn't tell me what kind.
No, no, you can't find that out that quickly,
no,
Kevin.
No, but my fucking surprise is all this data and all these surveys and all this information, how correct are they? How many people? I mean, I also want to mention, the night before we do the test, my wife, she did the self-test, the package that we get, mm-hmm. and my wife was negative. But she said, you know what, I'm still going to get a test next morning. But that came positive. So there are, again, millions of people who are doing the in-home test and is negative, and they're not bothering to go and do that other test. So that I've been thinking how many millions of people are walking around like me with no symptoms, and they think they don't have COVID.
Yeah.
I still don't have nothing. And
well,
by the way,
consider yourself lucky.
Those people who are against vaccine, you know what? Because I was double vaccinated, I didn't cost the government a penny to go to hospital. I didn't go to hospital. I didn't take anybody's space. So somehow these Pfizer's or this vaccine, Moderna, whatever, they're working. The bottom line is, if I wasn't vaccinated, I would be in an inhalator, like in an ICU. But if I was vaccinated, I'm just going on with my life. I just did my self-isolation. So get the vaccine. It's going to save your life, and it's going to save a lot of people's time and space at hospital.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad that you had no symptoms. You cannot draw that correlation that you had this, therefore this would have happened had you not. You don't know that. Let's be less like that. Jason, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Yeah, no, I was going to say the same thing, so I was glad you cleared that up. Because, yeah, most of the people that don't have the shot are also not having any symptoms or very mild symptoms. But I find this very positive news. It's actually giving me a little bit of hope because, what was it, 39% in Ontario believe we should abolish lockdowns. Like you asked this last winter, it probably would have been more like 10% or 7% or something like that. So I believe that the 23% that say it's going to be over, I believe it, if the thing keeps going the way it is, like the mentality keeps going the way it is, I believe the pandemic restrictions could be over this year. The pandemic's going to keep, like, the virus will keep going on. But we got to look at Florida, though. They've been no restrictions for a long time, and they're in the same boat we are. So have we really accomplished much is what I'm asking.
You know what, Jason, I'm not sure today we can answer that question, but that's going to be answered at some point. It is going to be answered. But again, cannot draw correlations from one person to another. You know, Kevin, as much as I'm really glad that you had no symptoms and, okay, you tested positive, it is not accurate to say, well, I got a vaccination, I didn't end up in the hospital. Okay, but that does not apply to everybody. And that is, didn't we have a discussion a couple of weeks ago about there are the extremes and then there's the middle? Somewhere in the middle, we try to meet. Rush, I see you there. We'll have to wait till we get back from the break. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Lots of data in the Angus Reid survey. Mostly it suggests to you that if you would like to pick out a position as a politician, recognize you will at some point be on some shaky ground when it comes to that. Lorraine, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I was wondering about this pandemic. A pandemic's a worldwide epidemic. And at what do we know what numbers it ceases to be a pandemic? It would still be worldwide, but in smaller numbers. Like the flu is apparent everywhere in every country, probably, but in small numbers. And I was just wondering if we knew.
Well, and so the flu, obviously, it's more seasonal, right?
Yes.
We know that. And pandemic, of course, pan. So it's kind of across. Do we know how we move out of the pandemic? Lorraine, I'm afraid that the end of this is going to be a disappointment for anyone who's ever watched a Hollywood movie. I think it will end with a whimper and not with a bang.
Yes, but I was wondering if we know numbers yet as to what percentage of the world.
No, I just don't think that is the way the mathematics works, Lorraine, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
But
okay.
Thanks, Lorraine. And I do believe that. I don't think this ends with Randy Quaid stepping out of a spaceship and saying, it's all over, everything go back to, that's not the way. I think it ends, like I say, with a whimper and not particularly with a bang. That is certainly to a large degree the way Spanish flu ended, different times. It's hard to compare the two. But, you know, I don't think there's going to be this dramatic moment where someone's just going to stand up and announce, it's over for everybody. No, it's going to be less dramatic than that, which is sad, because if Hollywood was doing it, it would work in a much better way. But everybody's looking for the end. And I completely and utterly understand that. I think we all want the same thing. Coming up still, a little later on this afternoon, University of Waterloo, studying CBD, synthetic, not the real thing, and its effect on COVID-19. There may be some promise there. Now, sadly, for those aficionados around here who have spoken about their use of cannabis, you don't get the high on this one, so you'll have to wait that one out. But it may have some applications which might be worthwhile. That's just after 2:30. And on the other side of the news update, why kids have always been a pain in a certain part of your body, and that will never, ever, ever change. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. Darn teenagers today, never home, causing trouble, promiscuous, think they know everything. That's what's wrong with kids today, and apparently from centuries ago. Creighton Avery is a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at McMaster University and joins us this afternoon. Good afternoon, Creighton.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm checking off the boxes. I've had 7 philosophers on this show. You, though, are the first anthropologist.
Oh, well, I'm honored to be the first one, then.
Well,
hopefully not the last one.
Don't be too honored.
Okay.
This is fascinating to me, because obviously when you do this type of show, you will hear people all the time complain about those damn kids today and how lazy they are, et cetera, and how they have it so easy. And it is apparent from what you're writing that this is not a new problem.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Some of the things we see today that we think is wrong with teens, we've been seeing for thousands, if not longer, thousands of years. But there are some really interesting differences as well that are coming out.
I've argued for years, Crichton, that Mozart's parents probably hated his music. It just seems to make sense to me. You study bones and teeth from centuries ago and study that from teenagers. How can you learn something from that?
Oh, through many years of specialization, unfortunately. But yeah, by looking at bones and teeth, we can try to see how different parts of their lives may have impacted their bones and teeth. So if they got injured a lot as kids, those might show up as fractures in their bones. Or I look at teeth, and actually they kind of capture some of the foods people were eating. So the phrase, you are what you eat, is a little bit true. And so by studying these bones and teeth, we can start to figure out what life might have been like for some of these people.
Now, how far back do you go in numbers of years?
Oh, it depends on the researcher. For myself, I look at the Roman Empire, so about 2,000 years ago. But some of my colleagues look back to the Upper Paleolithic, so we're talking upwards of 50,000 years ago. And they make a lot of really interesting comparisons to modern kind of hunter-gatherer groups to see what teens today are doing in those same environments versus what they might have been doing up to 50,000 years ago.
So you go back to Roman Empire times. That is, that's my childhood. So
excellent. So then you'd be the first-hand account.
Well, there you go. I'm very helpful in your research. What can you tell us about teenagers of that time?
Yeah, so I use bones and teeth a lot, but then I try to use a lot of different lines of evidence to help kind of figure it all out. It's kind of like investigatory reporting in a way. And so these literary sources written by wealthy men in Rome say that adolescence was a period of hooliganism and debauchery, which I think are some of the best words out there.
No kidding, sounds like fun to me.
Right, yeah, they're encouraged to drink heavily and and visit brothels sometimes and start small businesses. But then in my research, what I'm finding is that's not really true of people in middle or lower class families. These people instead needed to get jobs and start providing for their families. So it wasn't really hooliganism and debauchery. It was getting up early to go to work and staying late and working overtime, unfortunately.
So similar in many ways, I hate to say it, to what we have now. And those in the, let's call them the upper classes, you know, the lower income areas, those socioeconomic levels, have to worry about survival in the next day way less than the people in the upper levels do, right?
Exactly, yeah. They have to worry about getting food on their plate and developing a skill that's really going to set them up for success in the long run, whereas people in the high class, they could go off and party and know that their family was going to be there to support them in different ways. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of this less than ideal behavior.
And I wonder in some ways, because if you go back to those times, obviously life expectancy was a much different situation. Does that have an impact on the activities of an adolescent when you're 14 and maybe you only live to 35?
I don't know. That's an interesting question that I'd want to look into more, because we do see that teens in the Roman Empire and other time periods were still taking on really risky behaviors. Like, they tend to have so many more fractures than young or middle adults or even younger children, that maybe they have that same invincibility complex that teens today have. And so they're still participating in a lot of this risky activities, seemingly not too worried about their own mortality.
But we talk in this article about being wired for innovation. Let me go back to Mozart for a minute, who is creating something different from what has been heard before. So there's a level of musical innovation there. Is that the case, that maybe those who are adolescent are just wired to explore things in different ways?
Yeah, that's one of these things that this research is really starting to show is today we kind of think of teens of creating all these TikTok challenges and coming up with slang faster than I could ever possibly learn all of this slang. But we're seeing that in the past that these teens were also really doing more innovative practices. They were traveling further than adults did. They were developing new stone tools or new art forms. So those same patterns that we see today, we've been seeing for thousands of years, just as a matter of kind of their application or where we're putting that focus, I guess, is the difference.
So what's the application for this kind of research, Creighton? Is it just simply to tell the parents, calm down, this has been a problem for centuries?
I mean, I think parents would love to hear that some of these behaviors are just kind of how the brain is wired and how we develop evolutionarily. So it's okay if the teens want to go out and explore and try new things. That's kind of inherent to who they are. But I think it's also really interesting to start to see where the differences are. So in way back in the past, we're seeing that this rebellious stage was not always part of life. And so it raises the question to me of why is it part of life today? And what could we change about our society so that it doesn't have to be part of life? And maybe we could get over the terrible awkwardness of our teenage years and have a little more enjoyable time.
But on the one hand, you know, we're saying that that rebellion, that exploration is a natural part of adolescent life, but then we can possibly find ways to, I don't know, eliminate it or mollify it to a certain degree. I'm not sure I want to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a matter of getting rid of it, but maybe putting it to better use. Like one of the things we're learning about the adolescent brain and how it's wired for innovation is, yeah, there's a lot of teen slang and new music and things coming out, but teens are also developing new ways to detect cancer or filter water in places that don't have routine access to clean water. And so if we could take that innovative nature and that unique way of thinking and apply it to these big world problems, maybe our world would be better off altogether just by using this aspect of adolescence.
And I've caught you in my web of things parents have said before, because you said maybe we could channel this in a different direction. How many parents out there have said, you know, if you spent half as much time on your homework than you do on your skateboard, you'd be better off? You're just saying the same things, Creighton. Come on.
Yeah, and it just takes me a lot of research to be able to get to that point. I don't have teams of my own, so maybe I'll figure it out again at that point.
I do find that really interesting, though, that that much of what we say, look, we know at some point, maybe it's a Paleolithic era, maybe it's another area, that there were probably these adolescents banging rocks together and the parents were yelling, just turn down that noise. We know that was happening, right?
Yeah, or that's not the way we make that stone tool. Why are you doing it that way? And then it turned out that stone tool actually was better.
To me, it's kind of fascinating. I guess we can never really know what those lives were like, but at least we get a bit of a glimpse, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We can never really know how irritated parents may have gotten with them, but it's interesting to see some of these different behaviors coming through and what's the same and what's not.
Oh, I can imagine how irritated those parents were. I had three of them. I'm fully aware. And they were all teens at the same time. It was so much fun. Creighton, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Creighton Avery is a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at McMaster University. The teenagers from centuries ago engaged in, and I think Creighton's right, these are two of the greatest words in the English language, hooliganism and debauchery. There are no two better words. That's what teenagers were engaged in, or at least that's what their elders said they were engaged in. Their definition of hooliganism and debauchery may differ from yours and mine. Of course, we complained about our own kids being engaged in that kind of behavior. And I've got a daughter who's got an 11-year-old who is probably going to accuse her of being involved in that kind of behavior. But it's interesting when they talk about pushing boundaries, because I look at an 11-year-old granddaughter and look at the things that she puts up on TikTok or maybe some other things. Very heavily monitored account. Don't worry about that. And just a creative bent that I don't think I would have had at that age, but she certainly is comfortable with that creativity and with that openness. So they push those boundaries a little bit that way, which is what we do as kids. And as Creighton says, yeah, sure, you could channel it into a different direction. How many parents have said that too? To put down that damn guitar and do something worthwhile. Heard that for a while too. Still haven't put it down. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
By looking at bones and teeth, we can try to see how different parts of their lives may have impacted their bones and teeth. So if they got injured a lot as kids, those might show up as fractures in their bones. Or I look at teeth, and actually they kind of capture some of the foods people were eating. So the phrase, you are what you eat, is a little bit true.
Creighton Avery, a PhD candidate in the Department of Anthropology at McMaster University, writing in the conversation that if you're having trouble with your teenagers, it's not exactly something new. It's been hanging around for thousands of years. Now, in Roman times, there were times of the Roman Empire, there were complaints, and this was specifically aimed at upper-class kids, that they were full of debauchery and hooliganism. That was different for people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, because in many cases, you were sending kids off to work, off to do something, just simply trying to survive. It was a obviously far different situation than it is today. According to her research, less rebellion when you go further and further back to Neolithic times, there tended to be more of a sense of autonomy. That could, in some ways, be related to age. Being a teenager, let's say 15, during the Roman Empire, where your life expectancy probably wasn't much more than 35 or 36, you're already halfway through your life. That is a very different situation than it is today, obviously, but some things are the same. She says they displayed levels of creativity and tending to push the boundaries. Well, that still happens now. And innovation, which we do see. So I mentioned that example of you know, kids being told they spend too much time on their skateboard. Well, those kids who spent too much time on their skateboards ended up turning skateboards into an Olympic event, and some of them are doing pretty well on it. So criticize if you must, but those innovations have come along as things have changed. I just thought it was really interesting, because you see it all the time. especially on social media, when something happens and some teen or another is picked up for something, and all of a sudden you'll have the great hue and cry from people about how this is all, you know, because of absent parents and terrible things and what's wrong with kids these days. And there isn't anything wrong with kids these days. Most of them are really, really good. Just the same as even in our day, most kids are really, really good. Now, we did occasionally do stupid things, because most of us do. At some point in our life, or, you know, we do something idiotic. I certainly have a couple of scars to prove that. And every generation does complain about the same things. Doesn't mean that you want kids to perhaps do risky things, but they do it. Most of us get through it. Now, Creighton says maybe we could channel that teen rebelliousness, etc., into different ways. Well, usually people get over it. They move on. Never going to have a perfect world. Good to know that it wasn't perfect in Roman times either. Because imagine, the youngest Roman emperor was 13 years old. That's a pretty big responsibility to have on your plate when you're 13. There were plenty who were in their 20s. Again, would we have an empire, an emperor here in their 20s? It was a different time, but still there are some things that are interesting. And then there are also some pretty key differences from thousands of years ago, which goes along the line of autonomy and learning, because really by the time you were young, you had to learn how to throw a spear, you had to learn how to do a variety of different things to allow you or your family unit to survive. That's not quite the same. Although, you know, in many neighborhoods, kids are heading out to get a job because that's the only way that they maybe can get some of the things that they need or want. That's different in some socioeconomic levels than it is in others. There's all kinds of interesting work that goes on out there, and I am legitimately fascinated by those times, not necessarily the historical parts of it, but more about the regular everyday parts of life. You know, how did this work? How did the structure come together? How did one thing happen here and another thing happen there? And I really find those concepts of day-to-day life and those things very interesting. It is hard at times to find that information because not everything you read, sadly, is the absolute truth. Even years and years and years ago, authors would embellish to get better readership. Those things happen. I heard Mike this morning talking about Amy Schneider out of Jeopardy, who I don't know how she loses. I've been told in the past that some people quite simply just wear down after a while. Maybe that's the case, but I have yet to find a category where she isn't good at it.
Hold on. I missed the very beginning of that. Did you say there's a rumor that she doesn't win tonight?
No. I'm saying I don't know how she loses.
Oh, okay.
Because I've been watching her. I've watched almost every game of her streak.
Mm-hmm.
And usually at that, I can find somebody who's got a weakness somewhere.
Right.
She doesn't have a weakness. There was a category the other day, 2021 Grammy Awards.
Yeah.
She swept it.
Wow, eh?
Like, that's very remarkable.
And they film these things 2 months ahead of time. Who knows? Maybe the streak is still going on right now, even.
Entirely the case. Yeah, they do film a couple of months. Well, they film a couple of months, and they take a couple of months off.
Okay, because Farwell and I were talking about this morning. So they film a bunch of shows in one day, and then they'll come back the next week and film a bunch more or whatever. What do they do with the contestants? Do they put them up in a hotel room for 6 days?
I know that she's been staying in a hotel.
Okay.
Now, whether or not she pays for it, I don't know. I know we had somebody call this morning who said, yeah, the contestants have to pay for it.
I don't believe it.
I would believe that if you're a one and done. Like, you come into town, you shoot it. And then you're out. Yeah. I could see that, but I think if you're on there for 2-3 weeks, I would think.
You would think so, yeah.
Merv Griffin Enterprises or somebody is going to come up with some cake for that. Now, she's from Oakland, so, you know, when she's not shooting, she can go back
to... Yeah, Oakland to L.A. is, what, maybe 3 hours,
yeah,
maybe?
I
don't even know.
It's not that bad. It's Northern California. So
yeah.
She can go back and forth that way. If you're from Iowa... That's a slightly different situation.
That's
so I would imagine if you're a returning champion, they would, they would put you up to some
degree.
That
would make sense. If you have to wait a week before your next filming, they'll put you up in a hotel.
Yeah, or maybe they split the cost. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever they decide to do. But I just find it fascinating that day after day after day, you realize she really doesn't have a whole lot of weaknesses. Because I do believe this, that I do believe they toss categories in there in an effort to find someone's weakness.
To try and dethrone somebody.
Well, just to test them. Not necessarily to try to dethrone them, but to say, okay, we're going to do this and see if we can find something. And so far, like, it hasn't really mattered. Usually you can find somebody and they have a weakness somewhere. Like, I know that my personal weakness would be U.S. presidents.
Okay.
I know some stuff about U.S. presidents, but if you ask me to name them in order from the 1830s, I can't do that. They can. So I'd need to study that kind of stuff. And
how much would you need to study, though, right? I mean, if you kind of know the basics of the U.S. presidents and the main stuff that they did.
They have a significant amount of...
Like, you can... Probably about 3 or 4 hours of studying, you can probably get the basics down.
They have a significant amount of presidential trivia and then United States government cabinet trivia, like secretaries of defense, etc.
I wouldn't know that stuff.
I realize that's my weakness. And also, I'm not as strong as you might think on opera. But then no one is. Really. She probably is. She probably is. I say the same answers all the time for opera. Puccini, Madame Butterfly. That's what I do. And hopefully I'll hit one of the five. It's a simple system. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.
Well, when I got home from work last night, I hid it straight from my stash, you know, because I wanted some of my private blend, which is 2 parts brass to 1 part hash. Well, when I got to my little secret hiding place and I checked out my little plastic bag, well, there wasn't a speck of that nice leaf left, and I felt my whole spirit sag. There's nothing but twigs and seeds. Twigs and seeds. They sure don't.
All right, let's be clear here that when we are talking about CBD in this place, we are not talking about the psychoactive nature of it. You are not going to get a high from what we talk about over the next little while. That being said, Holly and I have established that if we're going to do even remotely cannabis-related segments, we're going to play music that fits what we want to do. But that's just us being us, so please do not send emails and get angry at us. Maria Fernandez joins us from the University of Waterloo this afternoon. Good afternoon, Maria.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Very interesting. I guess 3 years into this legalization of cannabis, it does really give us an opportunity to discover what some of the things are it can do, right?
Yes. I just want to clarify that what we used in the lab for this study was purified CBD, so that was pharmaceutical grade. So it's something that, yes, it comes from marijuana, but it's really not the same. It's a substance that was purified.
It doesn't offer the high. It doesn't offer
it
the buzz,
not,
right?
It does not at all. Yeah, no, it's non-psychoactive. Yeah, you won't get any high. Even if you have a lot of CBD, you won't get any high. Yeah.
Now, what we are discovering here is that it helps prime the immune system. Is that what we learned?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, we were super excited to see that. Yeah, it looks like even in healthy cells, in cells that we did not infect with some proteins from the COVID genome, we saw, I can say, maybe an activation of the immune system to simplify what we saw, and looked like it makes the cell ready in case there is a virus infection. And when you have these cells previously infected with CBD, the response is even greater. So not only CBD will activate the immune system, the immune response, but will cause the infected cells to die. In other words, the infected cells won't be able to infect healthy cells and spread the disease. So, yeah, we were very excited to see these findings.
So it essentially boosts the immune system, right? But doesn't...
Yeah.
But doesn't set anything into action until a virus comes in. Is that accurate?
Exactly. That's it. That's it. You got it.
And because of that, what kind of, we're talking beyond COVID-19 here in terms of of promise. What kind of promise does that hold? Not that I'm asking you to cure anything here. I just like to kind of relate that to people.
No. Yeah, I want to actually stress this. This is a very, that's a preliminary study. We still need to run human trials, and we have collaborations for potential human trials and studies in mice first. But, I mean, this is just the cellular work. It is really promising, really promising. As an antiviral drug, because it really looks like it's priming against a viral infection. It works against COVID-19, but we are now studying, we have ongoing studies in the lab looking into other viruses and how CBD can help. So, yeah, it's a really promising treatment, definitely.
Now, you mentioned that this is not psychogenic, so that's important. Is there any connection with the psychogenic form of cannabis where you could say, well, it does a similar thing, or do we know?
No, I don't know that. We actually, in our lab, we actually have just this purified CBD. We never studied any other compound that will actually give you the high, and we never, because in my opinion, I don't think this is ideal too, if you're trying to look for a potential treatment to help people with COVID-19. If you want to give something that will make them high, I don't think that's the idea, right? So, yeah, no, CBD is actually not going to give you the high, and we don't have any data on any other substances that comes from marijuana and will give you the high on COVID-19. We don't have this data yet.
And I just wanted to clarify that, because I generally know that someone's going to call me and tell me, well, we always knew that marijuana would boost your immune system.
Yeah, no, we are not claiming that at all.
This is... CBD has been looked at in the United States for working with some types of epilepsy, right?
Yes, that's it. And that's actually, I was happy to see that study coming out, because it gives a lot of support to our work. It kind of goes in the same direction, because they treated people with COVID-19 with Epidiolex. I believe it's the pharmaceutical, the name of the drug. That is the CBD in the U.S., and it really helps people. And then I got excited to see that. And that's actually, I cited this work on my publication, because it's really related. Looks like we are on the same page on the beneficial effects of CBD on COVID-19, yeah.
So what is the next step for this, Maria?
Yes, the next step for this, we have ongoing talks, shots, I can say, with the Winnipeg Biosafety Level Number 4 lab to see if they are interested in testing the CBD that we have here in Waterloo in their mice, because they can infect their mice with COVID-19, to see first how it, what's the effect in mice. If we see something similar, we should see, but I don't know. So that's ongoing. And another thing, we have a collaboration it's actually a partnership with a startup pharmaceutical company, small pharmaceutical company, and we are looking into human trials. So these are the next steps right now.
The CBD you're using, you said, is synthesized and purified.
Yeah, it's ultra pure, yeah.
So why the synthesization of it? Why not just use would it be a natural form?
Oh, no, we actually wanted, because we look into molecular mechanisms, so we really wanted the purified lipid, the purified CBD, to make sure that there's nothing else interfering. And so it's pharmaceutical grade, and I just want to make sure that people can understand that I'm not saying that you just go to the pot store and you buy CBD gummies and you start to take it. I cannot say that this is going to help you. So this is still under study in terms of dosage, so this has to be prescribed.
I guess that what you just talked about, though, is kind of where you would, I guess, in a perfect world, expect that you might hopefully, maybe possibly be able to go one day, where you could pick up something and take that, and it would boost your immune system against a virus.
Definitely, yeah. But we shouldn't, I don't want to claim anything before running the human trials and the mice study. You know, it's preliminary, it's extremely promising and very exciting. And I feel tempted to say, yes, go get your CBD, but I cannot claim this right now.
Maria, I appreciate your clarifications. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
Maria Fernandez is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Waterloo. There are so many things going on at the University of Waterloo in terms of medical research. But let's be clear, they are using CBD. It is purified. It is synthesized. It will not give you a buzz. So as Maria rightfully points out, do not go down to your local cannabis store, buy some gummies, and think that that is going to boost your immune system. This is the early part of the study, so it may possibly boost immune systems, and not just against COVID-19, perhaps against many other different kinds of viruses, and it may hold some hope for somewhere down the road. And it's interesting work that's going on at the University of Waterloo. We'll put a bookmark on that and see how the mice in Winnipeg fare if they get into the study. Back to wrap up and look ahead. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570. I get the sense, as we always do whenever we do even a slightly related segment to cannabis, that we're going to learn something. Andre, dude, tell me what.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Berg. I have to say that in our local neighborhood, that in your directory, we have amazing specialists and people on our show. And I have to share that I am on CBD oil. And in my case, I have multiple injuries in my body, and the CBD has took me off on a lot of medication that is bad for you. So I have a big say on CBD that it helps, and it's healthy, and it has 0% TH. So if it works for a lot of people, heads up, and hopefully we can go further with it.
All right. Thanks, Andre. Appreciate that. I'm just reading an article here from Harvard Health. Doug, go ahead.
Brian.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm all right.
You know, wouldn't it be ironic to find out that something that a substance that people have used for years and been persecuted for suddenly turns out to be a benefit to us? I realize that what they're studying right now, it doesn't have the TH in it, but if it does help, I just think it's going to be kind of ironic that we've persecuted so many people and fined them and put them in jail.
Oh, we demonized it for years, right? It's the devil's lettuce. It's everything.
The other thing, too, is it's funny that she should be studying that. That kind of blew the whole thing when the song you came back with, I was thinking you should have played Bob Dylan.
Well.
Everybody gets stoned. Anyway, the Jeopardy.
Yes.
Remember I talked to you a couple times about a thing called Uncle John's Bathroom Reader?
Yes.
There's one specific one that was given to me for my birthday that dealt completely with television. And it has a section. I'm pretty sure it's in this one. I've got like 12 of the darn things. But I'm pretty sure it's in this one. There's a section on how to get on game shows like Jeopardy. And the accommodation thing, initially you are responsible for your accommodation. But if you stick around, I believe after if you get more than a week, they cover everything.
Now, I have read, Doug, that obviously you need to pay to get to California. But
yep,
once you're there,
to get there. Yep.
Yeah, once you're there, they will cover the cost for your hotel, since the vast majority of people only spend one night because they shoot five shows in a day. So
that's the whole thing. If you ever get into something like that, it's incredible. I tell you to bring more than one outfit, because if you stick around for more than one day, they don't want it to look like you're wearing the same clothes.
You know what, Doug? I would absolutely on purpose wear the same clothes every day just to create an internet buzz. I would.
It would work too. That's great. Anyhow, I thought I'd give you that information. I my head's so full of a lot of crap. Thanks to Uncle John.
I know. Nothing wrong with having a head full of useless information, Doug. That's what my dad used to call it. Appreciate the call. Terry, go ahead.
Hey, hi, Brian. I don't know you're talking Jeopardy. It's interesting. A lot of those topics that they have on there, or categories, whatever you want to call it. That would take hours and hours and hours of researching stuff. I mean, I know the one category I had last, because I actually did watch last night, the one about streaks. I got I think I got 4 or 5 on that one, but it was all sports anyway. So, but do you remember in the 90s, there was a show they filmed in Toronto or shot in Toronto. It was called Game On. It was kind of a Jeopardy, but sports-oriented.
No. Actually, you know what? I kind of do remember a really cheesy theme.
Yeah, it was. They had like that model that came out, and she had you got a little, I don't know, a little a little trophy, I guess. It's kind of a novelty thing, but yeah, I actually at that time that show didn't last very long. I always thought of going on, but it didn't last long enough to even give me a chance.
Well,
I think
plus.
Only lasted a couple one season. One guy hosted, and the second season I think was the only. You know, the last season that they had, I think it was just a 2-season run. It was another host, so you could tell already that they couldn't keep the same host if the show was already in trouble. But it was kind of that same Jeopardy theme, but except it was all sports questions. And I thought, man, I'd go on there, I'd clean up, but never gave me the chance. But
no, but what would you do with your year's supply of legs pantyhose? Because that's largely what you win on Canadian game shows.
Yeah, or about a year's supply of Kraft dinner or something like that. But But in the States, sometimes they'd give away Rice-A-Roni, which is kind of comparable, I guess.
True, true. But you know,
that's only if you lost in the U.S. Up here, they give it to you as if you win. That's the difference.
Solid
consolation prize.
Can't argue with that. Thanks, Terry. Appreciate the call. I wonder why there hasn't been a Canadian Jeopardy. Like, I realize they make a fortune off it, but there is a Jeopardy, I believe. There are Jeopardies in other countries of the world. I know there's other versions of Wheel of Fortune around the world. I would assume that there's another version of Jeopardy somewhere. I don't understand why we haven't had a Jeopardy Canada, because we've copied everything else badly. So why wouldn't we do that?
Remember Rock and Roll Jeopardy?
Rock and Roll, yes, I do.
Yes, I used to watch that one.
Yeah,
that was good.
I don't think they need to have any other versions of it. I like the version that they have now.
Yeah, the original.
Yeah.
I do remember that Game On show that Terry was referencing. It was a sports trivia show.
Yeah, 1998 to 2000.
Yeah.
It was on Game TV. I'm not even sure that channel exists anymore.
Oh, it's around.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I've obviously missed that one. Tom, go ahead.
How are you, Brian? You're the type of guy that always likes to check both sides.
Sometimes.
I'm just saying they got, because these people are starving and dying in Afghanistan, 20 million, and they need 5 billion. Why all these people that wanted to help them before aren't contributing anymore?
Well, because it's not top of mind anymore, Tom. That's why.
Yeah. Now, the other thing with the Afghan people that we're bringing, these people are traitors. I mean, they helped the Americans, NATO, Canada, Britain kill their people. And that's why Taliban is after them. So,
Wait a minute. The Taliban was killing people too, Tom.
Yeah, no, I know. But I mean, this is what these people did. They gave information where they are. Stuff. So that's why they're going after them. And I mean, they may be good people because they helped Canada or U.S., but they helped kill their own people. So.
But they might also be good people, Tom, for we don't know the motivation of every one of people.
Well,
maybe the motivation was,
but, I mean,
we want this to
whenever
end.
Whenever we have, for example, people spying for the country, we put them in jail and whatever. Well, this is what they did to their own people, so... there's two sides to the story, but I mean, nevertheless, the bottom line is these people that are there, the whole country, they need help. And if you wanted to help them before, like you said you were doing, you should do it now. It doesn't cost that much.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Look, there's this great tendency. We will see things happen very quickly, and then there will be this outpouring of giving, but long-time support, in a lot of cases, doesn't necessarily materialize. Let's take, for an example, of you'll see earthquakes in places around the world. Look, some places can better handle an earthquake than others. Italy, maybe better to handle it than a place like Haiti or Nicaragua or El Salvador, any of those places. The initial outpouring and then nothing. That is pretty common in, you know, earthquake, floods, weather-related disasters, things like that. But these kinds of things, which this is not a weather-related disaster, this is, you want to say 20 years worth of trouble in Afghanistan, but go back further than that. You want to go back 40 years to when the Soviet Union was engaged in its activities there. That's how far back that goes. That didn't go anywhere either. But we forget, right? We don't forget. Well, we do forget. It's just when it's no longer front of mind, off we go, let's move on to the next one. And there is an old truism there that the further away people are, the less we tend to care about them. And I think there's a significant amount of truth in that particular saying. On a little bit of a lighter note, as we were just talking about Jeopardy a few minutes ago, and then we were talking earlier today about television themes, and it struck me that so many of those themes from, was it the 80s? I think it was 80s and 90s, right? Whether you call it a Full House or whatever they were, essentially the lyrics revolved around, look how much better life was at some completely unknown place in time. It's just life was better then.
Yeah, but look at the All in the Family. That was from like the early 1970s.
Same
right?
Thing.
Those were the days.
That's right. Life was better then. That is the basis of every family situation comedy. And then I started to think about things because I had this stuck in my head, Paulie. Who was the first married couple to be shown together in a bed on television?
Are you quizzing me? Or
yes.
I've heard this, and I can't remember
okay. The
answer.
No, that's fair. There are a number of different ones. There was, part of it falls into the problem of how do you determine network TV? Well, for me, that's pretty simple because it's a national broadcast that goes across the country.
Right. ABC, NBC, CBS. Right.
There was a television show back in the late 1940s, 1948, 1950. I can't remember the name. Scott and Mary Kate, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. It's the situation comedy, which did show the two of them together in a bed. Difference being they were married, actually married in real life.
Oh, okay.
Right? If you looked very closely at any I Love Lucy reruns, you'll see at times they seemed to have one bed, but in actual fact, it was twin beds, and they were separately made up.
Right.
So they
were just pushed together.
Right, and pushed together for convenience sake, thus yeah. Little Ricky. So
I never watched I Love Lucy, so no. I don't know the
reference. Actually, there's a pretty good biopic on Amazon about the Ricardos.
The only clip I've ever seen from I Love Lucy is, I don't know, they're at a factory or
right,
something,
the candy
and they're trying
one.
To keep up with right. The cookies or whatever it is on the line. Right,
but there was a pretty interesting documentary because Desi Arnaz was largely creator of the three-camera sitcom, et cetera, all those things that happened. So anyways, the answer to that question, I'm still trying to find out the exact answer, might actually be Fred and Wilma Flintstone.
What? They were a cartoon.
I know, but that might actually be the answer to the question. You can Google it if you want. You find all kinds of interesting answers in there. What it definitely was not the Brady Bunch, but it might be Fred and Wilma. Just letting you know that. Paul McPhee has popped in from the newsroom. Paul, what's going on out there?
Well, as we get closer to the return to in-person learning on Monday, local school boards working to get everything ready to go, while another provincial school board sent a blistering letter to the government over its handling of the effort.
One thing we learned from our Angus Reid poll today was that there are an awful lot of people who are really angry about a whole lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. Stake out your position at your peril. What else is happening?
Just go on Twitter to see that, right?
All you need to see.
We, of course, are breaking down the latest local COVID numbers. The federal government today announcing millions in funding for a pair of local affordable housing projects, one in Kitchener, one in Cambridge.
And the money racks up for that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It really does pile up in a hurry. Weather-wise, this is the last bit of mild for a few days, right?
This is it. We're looking at about minus 12 tonight for a low, which is actually normal
this
time of year. But after that, we're back into the deep freeze. It's going to be below normal after that for a few days.
Will we have double digits? Minus double digits?
Oh, please? Yes.
Oh, good. I just look forward to having minus double digits. Sports-wise, what do we have?
We aren't carrying anything tonight, and we will not be carrying a Rangers game on Saturday because that game in Erie has been postponed.
Okay. On the one hand, you'd like to play hockey. On the other hand, you would not like to be on a bus to Erie. What a very difficult choice that is. Thanks, Paul. Follow along all afternoon on City News 570. Back here tomorrow. It's Friday. That means it's Free Phones Friday. That means I get an hour off. Yay me. This is Kitchener Today on City News 570.